from 90.9 WBUR. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the similarities between this weekend's bombings in New York and New Jersey and the Boston Marathon bombings. Governor Baker says it's still too easy to make some explosives.
If you just go on the internet, it's a one-page document with drawings and descriptions, and unfortunately, it's not that complicated to make.
And some of the new science about the link between your mind and your gut. Also, changing the way Massachusetts schools teach about race.
I think students for multiple years have been very much itching to have more conversations about race and racism, specifically to think about their own identity, how they fit into the world.
Plus, comedian Marc Maron on how his WTF podcast began.
I had no gigs to plug. There was no way to make money, but I knew I just had to keep talking and doing something.
All that coming up on Radio Boston. First, this news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. After a dramatic shootout with police in New Jersey today, a 28-year-old man is in custody, charged with the bombings in New York and New Jersey over the weekend. Ahmed Khan Rahami is described as a naturalized citizen of Afghan descent who had been living with his family and helping run their fast food restaurant in New Jersey. Just to recap, on Saturday morning, a pipe bomb exploded near the course of a charity race in New Jersey. No one was hurt. Later that day, 29 people were hurt in the Chelsea neighborhood of Manhattan when a pressure cooker bomb exploded. A second bomb found in that area failed to detonate. Then on Sunday night, a backpack containing a pipe bomb was found near the train station in Elizabeth, New Jersey. Law enforcement officials detonated one of those devices early today using a robot. No one hurt there. We are still learning more specifics about the explosives used, but pressure cookers in particular have been configured into improvised explosive devices for years, including in the 2013 Boston Marathon bombings. Joining us to talk more about this is Bob Morris. He's a retired Army colonel and founder of the Global Campaign Against Improvised Explosive Devices. He joins us from WHRO in Williamsburg, Virginia. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me on.
So what do you make of the use of pressure cookers in New York? What does that suggest?
It just suggests a further expansion of the use of these devices by folks who would seek to do harm because they're very easy to build. You can buy everything you need at a local store. It takes a lot of the complex science out of making an explosive device when you use a pressure cooker.
You know, we heard from our governor, Governor Baker, today, and he said, just go online. One-page document shows you how to make some of these. Is it still that easy to do this? Is it really that simple? We heard that often during the marathon bombings, and I'm wondering, you know, I guess if it's that easy, sort of what can be done about it, right?
Well, that's correct. It's still that easy. In fact, it's even easier. There are more and more sites out there that do that. We recently have sent out alerts to various local schools because what's happened is it's become so proliferated on the internet now that a lot of juveniles can just go out there and look at how to build different types of devices out of different things, and there's actually websites set up where people talk about how they increased the blast capacity of certain things. What can be done about it is actually an interesting and complex question. We have over the years attempted to get Congress and the UN to take action to curb the flow of what's called precursor devices, the components that you could use to make an IED, and not really had much success because for whatever reason, politicians, especially as you saw following the Boston Marathon bombing, are reluctant to get engaged and in some cases even acknowledge there's an IED problem.
But in that case, we were talking about things like nails and BBs. I mean, those were the ingredients to make an IED, right?
They are, but there's also the knowledge of how to do it and some of the components that actually cause the blast. Since there's been such pressure put on purchasing actual explosives, and that's very monitored, now you can make them out of fertilizer, peroxide, and other homemade devices. The more complex problem is how you stop the proliferation of information. There, if you look at an analogy with what happened with pedophiles and folks with child pornography, the internet community came together, and some of the big folks in there, the Googles of the world, the YouTubes, and that, made a concerted effort to police themselves and shut a lot of that down, or identify and turn in suspects in those areas. Though that has not yet happened to the same degree involving IEDs, and it should.
I want to go back to just sort of making these types of pressure cooker bombs, if we're talking about those, because there were different types in Manhattan and New Jersey. There were also different types in Boston, that, as we learned during the trial. But one of the things that you mentioned, the explosives put into these pressure cookers, in Boston, it was essentially believed that gunpowder from fireworks, that was the material used in the pressure cookers at the Marathon finish line. In Manhattan, the New York Times is reporting that a compound called tannerite may have been used in those pressure cooker bombs. What do we know about that?
Well, it really, to follow the lead of the law enforcement up in New York right now, it wouldn't be appropriate for anybody to speculate on what the contents of those were. One of the things you saw in the Boston bombings was that because it took so long to get the suspects, there were certain gaps in information, and in certain areas people started to fill that in with wild speculation. But if it was Panorex that was used in there, that's also a readily available compound.
Panorex or tannerite?
I'm sorry, panorite. Mm-hmm. Is it's also a readily available compound. It's a type of pyrotechnic.
So you think that there should be some sort of regulation that would restrict the flow of information online about how these things happen, which, again, was something we heard in the Boston Marathon bombing trial, that this information was readily available online to teach people how to make these types of devices.
That's correct. And it could be done without any real infringement on people's human rights. I mean, you've got the Googles of the world and the YouTubes of the world and the folks that do a lot on the internet that could easily assist in identifying traces or tendencies of people when they start to put these things on. I mean, you've got these hacking groups that go out there, and most recently after Paris, a lot of them went out and attacked the ISIS sites. So, you know, folks like this could go down and shut down these sites, which obviously have no better reason than to spread information on how people can hurt other people. Hmm.
During the Marathon bombing trial, an FBI explosives analyst said that he could not determine where the Marathon bombs were assembled. And then testimony during the trial indicated that they were likely set off by model car controllers. Now, again, we don't know exactly what happened in New York, but the initial reports suggested cell phones had been used to set off these bombs. I mean, if it were cell phones, does that suggest a degree of sophistication above what we had experienced here in Boston?
It does. It indicates a slight increase in the sophistication involved, because when you're talking about a radio controller, all you really do is, for example, a radio controller on a car merely activates a motor, so it's an on-off switch. There's a little more sophistication involved in calling a cell phone and having the cell phone actually start a detonator. I mean, in an explosion, you have an igniter, which kicks off a small charge, which then kicks off the larger charge. So in this case, translating a very low voltage for the speaker or ringer on a cell phone into something that would set off that initial charge to cause the chain effect of the explosion takes some more sophistication. It's technology that's been used for years over in the Middle East on IEDs against our troops, but it would be a a ramping up of the technology involved in this in the U.S.
I'm wondering, I know that you have been spearheading efforts to try to take some sort of action against IEDs. Have things moved at all, particularly since the Boston Marathon bombings?
No, they really haven't. Not at the congressional level. At the local level, they have. And I think you saw in New York today some dramatic results of that. The alert that went out, the involvement of social media, the two homeless men who were really big heroes in this, who saw something suspicious and identified it to police, that's happened at the local level. At the national level, from the political perspective and what the laws and regulations that can help with this, there's been very little real movement.
All right. Bob Morris, a retired Army colonel and founder of the Global Campaign Against Improvised Explosive Devices. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, how Massachusetts educators are rethinking how to talk about the history of race in America. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. You probably know the expression gut feeling, that sense that your stomach might know something that your brain hasn't realized yet. Well, researchers are learning more about the connection between your gut and your mind and how they interact. Joining us to talk about this is Common Health Editor Carrie Goldberg. Hi, Carrie.
Hey, Deb.
So there's a book on this topic, The Mind-Gut Connection, and you spoke with the author.
That's right. That book is just out, The Mind-Gut Connection, and it has a subtitle that's very long, but it really sums it all up. It's how the hidden conversation within our bodies impacts our mood, our choices, and our overall health. And I caught the author when he was just in Boston. He's Dr. Emeron Meyer, a professor of medicine and psychiatry at UCLA, and an expert on the interactions between the brain and the gut microbiome.
And the microbiome being the full complement of microbes that inhabit our bodies.
Right, very good. So the microbiome is this sizzling hot area of research. We've talked about it here before on Radio Boston, and it's casting a lot of new light onto our roles as homes to the trillions of bacteria that inhabit each of us. So, you know, I just wrapped my head around the idea that I'm not just me. I'm also kind of a walking, talking mountain of microbes, right? And now, thanks to this new book, I also understand that my gut microbes are in constant communication with my brain, and there's mounting evidence that they may actually even affect how I feel, not just physically, but emotionally. So this raises the question of whether, at least to some extent, my microbes might be driving the bus, so to speak.
Not a comfortable question.
No, huh? But, you know, we do know of some cases where this does happen in other species. So I asked Dr. Meyer, are we being manipulated by our microbes? And he says the science on this is only in its earliest stages, but there are some indications that there are links between our microbes and, for example, the reward system in the brain. He has a really fascinating example from people who undergo obesity surgery. The research finds that right after surgery, they immediately stop wanting sweet and high-calorie food, and at the same time, their gut microbes change right away too, Emeron Meyer says.
So because there's such a dramatic change in the behavior of these individuals, and at the same time, this change in the bacteria, I would not say it's impossible that this concept of the bacteria being closely linked to our reward system and not deciding what we do, but influencing what we do. So, you know, I wouldn't say this is the end of free will, but it's definitely a major factor, I think.
So, Carrie, this means the next time I start grabbing a bunch of peanut butter pretzels at night, I can blame my microbes, right?
Right. Like they outnumber you trillions to one,
okay.
Right? Actually, Deb, no. Sadly, the science really isn't there yet. But let's say, just for example, that you happen to be stressed out tonight because, purely hypothetically, you have to moderate a great big debate tomorrow night. You already know that when you're stressed or angry, you're releasing stress chemicals into your own bloodstream, right? But what you might not realize is that those signaling molecules also affect your microbes, Dr. Meyer says.
When you're stressed, the main stress molecule, norepinephrine, that we secrete, gets to the microbes, changes their gene expression pattern, makes them produce different things, makes them change their behavior. So they know what state of mood you're in, and our brain knows what they, the signals that they send up to us. It's something that you're not aware somebody's talking to me, because it's part of you. It's part of us.
So it's all this like hidden crosstalk, right? It's this intimate connection, not just between our brains and our guts, but between our brains, our guts, and the microbes in our guts.
So if the gut influences the brain and vice versa, what does all of this mean for patients who have, say, gastrointestinal problems or who have mental illnesses, right?
Right. Well, and many people do have both, right? They have gastrointestinal problems that seem to influence their mental health, and they have mental health problems that may seem to influence their guts. So Dr. Meyer has a lot of patients like that. And I asked him, which is more the chicken or the egg, the mental health or the gut health? And he says research finds there's no definitive answer.
It's hard. I would say my patients, half of them would say it started with anxiety. The other ones had constipation, stomach cramps that they remember. You know, so, yeah, I can't give you a definitive. I think it's just two avenues to the disturbance of the brain-gut axis. One can be top-down, the other one bottom-up.
So a disturbance of the brain-gut axis and the crosstalk between the two. And Dr. Meyer says it can help many patients even just to explain to them how this works, that when patients are told their brain is involved, that doesn't mean they're being told this is all in your head, it's all psychological or hysterical, but rather that the brain is the body's main regulatory organ and it interacts very closely with the gut.
So since we're talking about bacteria in the gut, how about those trendy probiotics, right? They're supposed to increase quote-unquote good bacteria.
Right, and they're very trendy. Mm. So Dr. Meyer does recommend a general increase in probiotics, but in that he generally means eating more yogurt and fermented foods, which, by the way, are much more common in other cultures around the world. So I pressed him a little bit on commercially marketed probiotics because it seems to me they make a lot of claims that are not really backed up by good research. And he says, yes, it's a bit of a Wild West. And he's also very skeptical of, okay, now here is a new vocabulary word, Deb, okay? Psychobiotics. Hmm. Mm-hmm. He explains
that you can change your mood with the intake of a single probiotic, of a single strain of a microorganism. That that I think is really a myth. It does happen in the animal, but our brain is so much more complex. Mm-hmm. So I think we need to find out which diseases or subtypes of patients within diseases actually have an abnormal gut microbiome, and does that abnormal gut microbiome, is that the cause of their disease or is it the consequence?
So broadening out from psychobiotics to the whole future of this field of research, the effects of our gut microbes on our brains, Dr. Meyer says this is the promise, that if you can figure out when the abnormal gut microbiome is causing a disease, then you can try to treat the disease by manipulating those microbes, maybe with diet or other approaches that target the microbes. So it could open up some exciting new avenues for treatments that are more natural and not so pharmacological. Hmm.
Okay, so and then what are his recommendations then overall, Carrie?
Well, they're pretty commonsensical at this point, right? Like avoid artificial sweeteners, eat more of a Mediterranean diet and less of a North American one, be stingy about antibiotics. And Deb, he also says to try to avoid eating when you're stressed or angry or sad. So I don't know about your late night peanut butter pretzels,
okay.
Actually.
Well, I will make sure if I do eat them, I eat them calmly.
Yes, good.
Okay, Carrie,
good.
Thanks very much. Mm-hmm. Carrie Goldberg, editor of WBUR's Common Health blog. You can find a link to Carrie's full interview with Dr. Meyer at our website, radioboston.org. When it comes to teaching the complicated history of race in America, many Massachusetts teachers say textbooks are only one part of their lesson plans.
Well, the text doesn't really matter as much as the conversations, the writing, and the skills and critical thinking strategies that the students are using to tackle that text.
That's Amy McLeod, head of the curriculum department at Lowell High School, who says there's a movement away from textbooks. WBUR surveyed dozens of Massachusetts school districts about this, and we're providing that information in a series of reports this week. Tanya Mosley, senior reporter for WBUR's Edify, joins us to talk about this. Hi, Tanya.
Hi, Deb.
So first off, tell us, what did you find in your survey of school districts?
Well, we contacted 283 school districts in the greater Boston area, and we heard back from 141 of them. And what we found was that almost every district said that in the last year, they've either talked about how they are teaching race in the classroom, or if they haven't discussed it, they should be. We also found that the materials used to teach racial history vary. So of the 141 districts we spoke with, we found that there were 48 different textbooks used, published by 21 different companies. What this exposed for us was that while the state provides clear guidelines on what to teach, it's at the discretion of the educators to decide how they teach it.
Hmm. Were there any patterns in how different schools teach the history of race in America, or patterns in the materials that they use?
Well, what we found was that in areas with higher minority populations, they were more likely to find other materials to teach from that speak to the minority experience. So only 23% of the districts we spoke with, however, used textbooks as a primary source. In contrast, more than 60% of the teachers we spoke with use other materials besides textbooks as primary sources for teaching U.S. history. And a big portion of those teachers use digital sources because, one, it costs less, and two, digital sources are more interactive and then can be added or changed over time to accurately reflect what they like to teach to the students. We spoke with Tabidi Brown. He's the principal of Cotman Academy in Dorchester, and he explained why his school has moved away from relying on textbooks to teach U.S. history.
Our students can't see themselves in most of the history of this country as rulers. And they have been told, I think, via history textbooks, that they are not powerful, that they are not influencers, that they are not the ones who are decision makers.
Hmm. And Tanya, you have another piece coming out tomorrow that looks at how teachers are talking about race in the classroom.
Yes, well, in light of what's been happening in our nation in Ferguson and with the presidential election, I found that many teachers here in the Commonwealth are having direct conversations about race and racial inequalities in their classrooms. Almost every district we spoke with said they've either had conversations about this with their staff over the summer or last year, or they've had it with their communities over the last year. And in the case of Brookline High School, for instance, they've developed a curriculum based on this. It's called Race and Identity. And so I spoke with a teacher there, Kate Leslie, a bit about what she'll be talking with the students about and why it's important.
I think students for multiple years have been very much itching to have more conversations about race and racism, and specifically to think about their own identity, how they fit into the world.
But even still, the topic of race is really a difficult one, especially for teachers who aren't comfortable having these discussions with their students.
All right. Well, Tanya, I look forward to your piece tomorrow, but stay with us because I would like to bring another voice into the conversation. With us in studio is Abby Erdman. She's a retired Brookline High School teacher who now teaches educators about how to have these types of conversations. Welcome, Abby.
Thank you so much.
So you found that many educators still have personal issues around race that may influence their teaching. Can you explain?
So I think as white educators, we are not given the tools to talk about race, to acknowledge our own race, and we certainly don't feel comfortable bringing it up in the classroom. I know that I didn't until I started to lean into the work. Mm-hmm. We're afraid we'll make a mistake, we'll offend somebody. I think the issue is really different for black educators, but, you know, many white educators are struggling with this.
So what was a big challenge for you that you had to learn how to deal with so you could lean in?
So fear. Mm-hmm. And I was sort of held back by fear and guided by the gut. And just feeling that it was so, so important that students have an opportunity in the classroom to speak about these issues. Mm-hmm. They were everywhere. The issues were everywhere, and I just had to give them permission to say, this is going to be a classroom where it's okay to talk about race, mm. and we are going to do our best to have safe and challenging conversations.
Do you think that it helps most students, or are there perhaps some students who, in listening to these conversations, may realize that this is more of an issue than they initially thought it might be? You know, students who were never raised with any sort of prejudices or anything else.
Yeah, I think it's very easy for any of us white people to be clueless. Mm-hmm. And, you know, white students are no different from white teachers. I felt very clueless when I started doing this work. And I think it takes us really paying attention, reading, talking, listening, being open. And so I'd say it's been an amazing thing to watch students who, you know, weren't aware of race, weren't comfortable talking about it, suddenly go, I see it everywhere now.
Right. Do you find folks questioning your credentials because you're a 69-year-old white woman doing this, right? Sorry to say how old you were.
That's fine. I'm kind of proud of it. You know, the age can work both ways. And, you know, now I've been at the work for 15 years, 20 years, and so I have some experience under my belt. I don't feel at all uniquely qualified. I just feel like I've been drawn to do this work, and I feel if it's not me, then who? If it's not me, then who's going to do the work?
Right. I'm wondering, you know, we heard this piece of tape from Tabiti Brown, right, the principal of Codman Academy in Dorchester, saying that in history, a lot of students cannot see themselves as rulers, yet we have President Obama, right? So how does that affect the teaching of race in America?
I think we have to change who is on our walls, who's in our curriculum. I mean, I'm an English teacher, so there have to be text, great text, beautiful text, beloved Malcolm X, that are taught in the curriculum that, you know, students of color can see themselves in and white students can learn from. Mm. I mean, it's a deprivation for white students just as much for black students if the curriculum is very, very narrow. Mm. I had a class once called Great Books, and, you know, I asked the kids to vote on what books. And they made a list, Pride and Prejudice, et cetera, et cetera. And a couple of my kids who had taken the class on race and identity the year before said, we can't have a curriculum that's all white. And so we added Beloved, and it turned out to be everyone's favorite book.
So there's been a lot of debate in the higher ed realm about safe spaces, you know, trigger warnings, things like that. Have these things come up for you at all in the high school classrooms?
So when I taught about race, the whole class was devoted to race. And so we spent the first week talking about what does it look like to have a safe discussion, but what does it look like to have a hard discussion? Hmm. If we just stay safe, we're probably not having a very real discussion. And so we've talked about ways to be both honest and assume good intentions and assume that we're all learning here. Because I think, you know, the tendency for many white students is to pull back and say, oh, I'm sorry, oh, I don't, you know, and not really say, here's what I'm feeling right now. And if people don't, again, I have to go back to your piece, God, talk about the gut, then they're not really in the discussion.
Right. Go ahead.
So one of the techniques that I've borrowed from a great organization that was called EMI and it became IDEA is the word ouch. And what happened is that we said, we're going to use the word ouch. And if people are offending, someone in the room can say, ouch, just to reflect back to that person, not you're stupid, not you've made a mistake, just ouch, that's hurtful. Hmm. And then we can have that discussion. So I used to say to the kids, don't be afraid, you know, because how will we know how to have these discussions unless we make mistakes? Hmm. We are going to make mistakes.
Is there an anecdote that stands out in your mind when you think about how you started teaching educators about this and where you are now? Is there something that when you're describing this to folks, you know, a story from either teaching teachers or teaching students?
Yeah. Well, let me just say, when I started doing this, I was, you know, 35 years into teaching, and I felt like a brand new teacher. And I asked for a lot of help and support. And I finally got more used to it and less afraid of it. I think a comment that stands out was one that was made in my very first class by a student who was white and tall and handsome and privileged and clueless. And, you know, he would have been the first to say it. And at the very end of the class, I was asking them, what did you learn? And this student turned and said, I think I learned that when people of color speak, it's my job to listen.
Hmm. All right. Well, Abby Erdman, retired Brookline High School teacher who now teaches educators about how to talk about race, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Also, Tanya Mosley, senior education reporter here at WBUR. You can hear her reporting on Morning Edition on WBUR and at WBUR.org. Tanya, thanks so much.
Thank you, Deb.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Mark Maron has been a stand-up comedian for decades, but what made him well known are his long-form interviews with celebrities, artists, even President Obama. They're among the guests on his podcast, WTF with Mark Maron. We can't explain what WTF stands for here on the radio, but I'm sure you get the idea. Maron records the podcast in his garage in Los Angeles. Maron's IFC show, Maron, which he starred in, also had its series finale this summer after four seasons. He'll be doing two shows at the Wilbur Theater in Boston this weekend. When we spoke with Maron last week, we started by talking about the popularity of his podcasts. Because his podcasts are between 1 and 2 hours long, and the trend in broadcasting is toward shorter and shorter, we asked him why we thought his podcasts were so popular.
If you have a conversation that flows and is engaged, why wouldn't people listen? I don't know where that lack of faith came from. And just to let things pace out as they would in a conversation is something I think that people are maybe craving even in their own life. I mean, I seem to think there was a time, at least when I was younger, where, and then again, I chose a line of work that afforded me a lot of time to sit around restaurants and diners and comedy clubs talking to people. But, you know, walking around and engaging with another person for sort of free form, long conversations about whatever was a tremendous way to spend a day.
Mm-hmm. And do you sort of approach it with the thinking, I want to talk to that person because I want to shed light on that person as a human being? I want to have a really good conversation, which of course everyone does who has those kinds of conversations. But is it more about crafting a conversation? Is it more about getting to the person? Is it more topical? What's sort of your guiding principle when you're thinking of who you want to talk with, if you have one?
A lot of times it's like, you know, what's that guy been doing?
Right.
You know, or what is she up to? Or what does her life look like? Or where'd they come from? I don't, I'm not out to sandbag anybody or make anybody look bad. I'm usually out to sort of fulfill my own need to connect with people. And sometimes that works out and sometimes it doesn't. But ultimately, I'm looking to connect with them as people. And I think if anything happens in that garage that people really register when they're listening is, you know, people we grow to respect or idolize or appreciate their work in a general way because of movies or television or writing or directing, whatever they do, you know, our relationship with them is sort of not human. It's, you know, we appreciate the work and we hear gossip or we think we know the person or we get an idea of them. But what happens when they come in there, you know, it's hard to hide for an hour. And even if you're hiding, maybe that's a facet of your personality. So what the conversations become are sort of, you know, portraits of these people, hopefully emotional portraits of people in conversation at that time that I talk to them. And that's the best thing that can happen. It's not a matter of information, really.
Mm. You know, last year, you spoke with Lorne Michaels from Saturday Night Live, and loyal listeners of WTF know how your meeting with Lorne Michaels decades ago haunted you, really. Now, how did you feel about that interview, and how do you feel now afterward?
I was happy that he was able to sort of address that memory of mine. You know, I had to get some closure on that. So I appreciated the fact that, I went through my memory of that and he clarified things from his end or what he thought at that time. And I have to take his word. And that was definitely very helpful. And the feeling I got after mythologizing this guy and putting him up on a pedestal and assuming things about his power in show business and, you know, his power over that show, is that what I found very humanizing and almost humbling was that, you know, he's a guy that goes to that building and goes to work every day. And that to me was sort of a revelation.
So you got to feel that he was a little bit more human, and that made you feel better about what had happened years
ago?
Yeah,
man. I wasn't mad at him. And, you know, if anything, I don't think I was ready for that show, and I don't think that his decision was wrong. And, you know, and I was sort of cocky, and I had my own ideas about myself. So, of course, I'm going to kind of, you know, swagger through my own rendition of what happened for, you know, half my life. And make him a villain. Yeah, I was happy he remembered it, and I'd like to believe he was trying to help me, and I'll take that. Whether at that moment he was or not, I'll accept the older Lorne being gracious and paternal in a way.
I want to talk about your time in Boston. Mm-hmm. You were here, and it was here in Boston where you and Louis C.K. met in the 80s, right? He tells a story in the 2010 interview about seeing you at Catch a Rising Star, and saying he didn't love you so much on stage at that time. What do you think about when you look back on your time in Boston?
And then he saw me washing dishes at the Coffee Connection. He's like, oh, that guy's all right. Yeah, I mean, that was right upstairs, too. Well, you know, I went, you know, there's a lot of different times in Boston. You know, I went to college at Curry College out in Milton and for my freshman year, and that was that. And then BU. And then after college, you know, going to L.A., you know, having the first round of horrendous drug engagement, after less than a year in L.A., you know, I ran back to Boston to sort of reengage and start comedy over. And there's so many different phases of me in Boston. Mm. And I got to know New England very well because when I started working as a comic in 1988, after I came in second in the WBCN comedy riot, I lost to Sue McGinnis. You know, I started working. There were all these bars and grills and bowling alleys and discos and hotels that, you know, they'd have comedy nights. So the way I paid my dues working as a comic outside of Catch a Rising Star, which was sort of like a salon compared to the actual work you had to do, was you would get directions. You'd go to the office of the Boston Comedy Company. You'd go and Nina would give you a map. You know, and you're working for $75 and you're opening on a two-man show, a two-person show where the opener would do a half hour and the headliner would do 45. You're driving, you know, to Cranston, Rhode Island to perform at a bowling alley bar, or you're driving up to Mother Shapiro's up in Burlington at the ski area, or you're going out to Pancho Villa's in Leominster to perform under a disco ball.
But I'm not hearing real happiness to be quite honest.
I don't know how I did it, Deb. I don't know who that kid was. He was aggravated. He was, you know, socially different than most of those audiences. You know, I was this angry Jewish guy. I don't know how I did it, but I did it. You know, I once drove like 8 or 9 hours to Machias, Maine to open for a hypnotist at a college. So, but it was all I wanted to do.
You know, it just reminds me of something. There was an interview that with Billy Crystal, and he told you that he had a mantra about his career. Don't settle in. You said yours was hide the hate. Yeah, I'm wondering, like, did that kid get in the way for a long time, do you think? And you were able to resolve things that allowed you to have success? Or what happened there?
You know, my hate was a sort of, you know, a self-hatred that was projected that, you know, I assumed that the audience wouldn't like me, you know, always. I assumed walking out on stage that it was going to be trouble from the get-go. But, you know, I was also, you know, a Jewish kid that grew up with parents from New Jersey who liked Buddy Hackett and Don Rickles and Jackie Vernon and, you know, Woody Allen. You know, so somewhere along the line, my nature had sort of been steamrolled by, you know, my fear and my contempt. It took me a long time to find myself in my own body with my own heart and mind connected to what I was doing. So, settling was never really a choice for me.
Right. Why so much fear and contempt?
Well, I mean, I don't know. That's a good question for anybody, isn't it?
Yeah,
I mean,
it is.
I don't know why I chose comedy to, you know, to find myself. You know, it seems like the most adverse thing to do that, mm-hmm. But there was something about being seen, being witnessed. You talk to a lot of comics and they go up there, you know, wanting to be loved. I think I had that, but I was going to fight it if it was coming to me, which I think makes me a little different.
In an interview with Alan Alda, he asked you if you have kids, and you said no. When you're 52 years old and you don't have children, someone's right. What did you mean by that?
I said that? Well, look, you know, it just wasn't, you know, I've been married twice, and I don't know, you know, if it's unhealthy or healthy or what, but you know, whatever my parents did, however I brought up, I have a certain amount of anxiety and self-centeredness. I never thought about it. Yeah, it's hard for me just with cats. You know, I panic, you know, if they're not eating. I don't feel that there's a void in my life. Maybe I will another time, but I'm not wired that way, and I'm okay with it.
You decided to end your IFC show, Marin, after four seasons this year. Why is that?
Well, how many do you need to do? You know what I mean? I don't need the money. So the truth was is that we had told all the stories, and, you know, we did three seasons, you know, that were directly based on my life, and one sort of season that was a cautionary tale and sort of a darker exploration of the possibilities of, addiction and losing success. I felt like we had a nice end to it, and I thought the story was nice, the arc was nice, and I loved the way it ended. And I don't need to do things I don't want to do.
Well, I want to just talk a little bit more about that dark cautionary tale, where in season four, when a back injury leads to an addiction to painkillers, it's a big deal right now nationally. But why did you want to get into that on the show, and is that something that you worry about personally? Right after 17 years of sobriety yourself, is that right?
Right. Well, I mean, I feel pretty grounded in my sobriety, but certainly, you know, being a guy who does recovery, and you do see it happen, and that's usually how it happens. So to sort of depart from my real life narrative a bit and explore that was good for me to see how easy it happens, and also it was interesting to go explore the idea of, like, you know, having something and then having absolutely nothing. The whole life of an addict, when that happens, no matter when it happens and what happens to your life, is profound and horrible. I just wanted to honor that somehow. I wanted to, you know, why build this world where I just podcast and, you know, have problems with women and whatever? We didn't need to honor that. You know, we were on IFC. We could do whatever we wanted. So when the idea came, you know, that I relapse, I was like, this is amazing. Like, I didn't even know if I was going to do a fourth season. And then I sort of had this epiphany that if we can do it where it's like three different shows where, you know, I'm strung out and I got to get clean, and then I got to figure out how to transition into life, and then I change my life drastically. Like, if we could break it down like that, it would be a very challenging and exciting thing to do. But for me, it was an exploration of something that is very possible. I'm not personally afraid of relapsing, but I am, you know, deeply afraid of drugs and alcohol, and you know, I'm pretty I know in my heart and my mind that I can't do them, but again, you know, it happens. I see it happen. I see cats with 20 years sober, you know, decide that they can, you know, try it again, or they get strung out because of an injury.
Mm. So is sobriety still a struggle for you, or what do you think is the key for you to being successful?
No, sobriety is not really a struggle. I just make sure that, you know, I do a bit of the work around it, you know, staying, like, I don't have any desire to drink or do drugs, but, you know, I get a little crazy sometimes. So I got to check in with the secret society, you know, and I still actively, you know, engage with that. You know, I talk to sober people all the time. I have sober friends. You know, I have a sponsor that I talk to. The key to success for me, I don't know. You know, it came around the side. I didn't know. When I started the podcast, I didn't think it was going to happen. I just needed to stay active.
Mm. Now, I've read that you don't like talking about politics, but you did mention on the podcast that talking about politics on stage and hearing in yourself a tone of intensity and anger was one that you used in your stand-up when you were younger. But, you know, we're also in the midst of a contentious presidential election. Is it tough to stay away from politics or not really?
I've been doing a bit on stage. You know, I don't want to use the podcast that much for a platform of that. But I've been talking about politics for a bit of my act. I try to be as empathetic as possible to those that are wrong-minded. And but see, then it becomes an opinion anyways. I just find it all very embarrassing for a lot of reasons and very frightening for other reasons. But I do have a certain amount of faith in democracy and humanity. I'm not as cynical as people think, but I'm not thrilled with the environment of information, if that's a nice way to put it. Mm. That, you know, there's this capacity now for people to be so fragmented because we really share so little of the same information that, you know, is even, you know, necessarily journalistic.
You know, you talked about this polarization with President Obama when you spoke with him last year. I think there was a lot of that in there about the fragmentation of media and sort of the echo chamber that people can get themselves into without really getting any information. Was that what was that interview like? And what was your ultimate goal, do you think, in talking with him?
My goal was to talk to the guy. You know, my research was very specific. I read his first book before he had presidential aspirations, certainly, which was a book about his struggle with, you know, his purpose in life and his own identity, racially and otherwise. And I thought, well, that guy's got to still be in there. And it would be interesting to talk to him. I knew that it was going to be a risk to stay away from politics, but I had an hour. And his agenda, as he stated on the show, was to get people involved in politics. And I learned that during the show. I mean, obviously, I knew that he made a choice to talk to me for a reason. He was looking for an audience of a certain type, and it was my audience, and the event was the event. But I found that, you know, very quickly I was, you know, calling him man and, you know, and finishing his sentences for him. So there was a comfort level that was achieved, and I'll have to give him the credit for that. And what I like about him a lot is that he's not the guy, you know, if you walked into a party with a lot of people and Barack Obama was there before he was president, you know, he's not going to be the guy that everyone's, you know, rallying around to listen to stories. You know, he's not a raconteur. He's not a, you know, like he's not this obsequious, charming, handshaker. You know, he's a thinky guy. I mean, I would think that if you went into a room before he was president and he was there, you'd be like, is that guy okay? What's he thinking about? You know what I mean?
So do you think you would have had all of these successes if you hadn't started the podcast?
No way. Huh. No way. And yeah, it all came from that, you know, moment of desperation to do something without a plan, without any idea of how it would make money. I had no gigs to plug. There was no way to make money, but I knew I just had to keep talking and doing something. So it wasn't even a Hail Mary pass. It was just me avoiding slipping into the darkness in all that that implies. You know, the podcast really does better for me, you know, as a job than any of the other things at this point. So I'm being afforded the opportunity to really do everything I wanted to do as a young comic, you know, which is television and a bit and have an audience as a comic. You know, it's not massive, but it's manageable for me, and it's better in that sense. So, you know, I do have fantasies of, it's weird. I do have fantasies of doing nothing.
Really?
Yeah.
You don't sound like you have a personality that could do nothing.
People say that, but I wonder. I mean, you know, nothing doesn't mean I won't be doing anything, but not like there. Like the beautiful thing about where I'm at now is that, you know, there are a lot of elements of my self-esteem have been sort of, you know, kind of filled in a lot of the holes there because of, you know, you work 20, 25 years at something. It's nice to connect and do something that people enjoy and get a lot out of and seems, you know, relevant to people. I like, hopefully I can begin to enjoy it because I still seem to make myself pretty crazy.
Oh, right. I wonder if it's almost difficult. Do you say, okay, is this it?
Well, that's not what I think. What I think is, like, you know, the other shoe's going to drop or I'm a fraud. Like, there's no sort of like, yeah, I'm here. You know, I would welcome that for 10 minutes. For me, because of my anxiety and just the way I'm wired, you know, my brain would much rather be filled with panic and dread than excitement. And they're very similar. It's a very slight adjustment.
Okay, Mark Maron, comedian and host of the popular podcast WTF with Mark Maron. His IFC show, Maron, which he starred in, had its series finale this summer after 4 seasons. He'll be doing 2 shows at the Wilbur Theater in Boston, Saturday, September 24th. For more information, you can go to our website, radioboston.org. Mark Maron, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And before we end today, just a reminder to our listeners, tomorrow we'll be back at the McCormick Graduate School at UMass Boston for the second in our series of live debates on the ballot questions before Massachusetts voters this November. Tuesday's debate is about question 3, which proposes to limit confinement of some farm animals. We'll have the leading voices on both sides, and Joshua Miller of the Boston Globe is our co-moderator. If you want to attend, go to wbur.org/events. Tickets are limited, and you can listen live tomorrow at 3 here on 90.9 WBUR, or you can watch the video stream at radioboston.org. That's it for today. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston.